Georgia's DBHDD has an urgent health warning. One of every 10 counterfeit pills contain fentanyl, a powerful and very deadly drug. Pills from friends or dealers are unsafe, and one pill can cause an overdose. More info at opioidresponse.info.
It's the start of a brand new week here on Political Rewind, Monday, March 22nd, 2021. Glad to have all of you with us for our show today. As I'm sure all of you out there know, the news of the spa shootings last week continued to dominate headlines, not just here in Georgia, but nationally as well. There were demonstrations in a number of cities protesting against anti-Asian hate. There was a demonstration downtown. Hundreds of people showed up out of concern for the fact that of the eight people who were killed, six of them were Asian Americans, and seven of those women. And so there's been a lot of concern about racism, misogyny that people have been talking about. We're going to talk about that. Joe Biden, of course, the president, was in town on Friday, along with Vice President Harris. The public appearances of their visit took place after we were off the air on Friday. So I really want to talk a bit about what President Biden had to say about the shootings, but also during a visit to the CDC, what he had to say about COVID-19. So we're going to talk about all that. Election bills that are on the table still with only a week left in the legislative session, and a lot more on today's show. We're joined, as I am almost every Monday, by my good friend Jim Galloway, the former political analyst, political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, good to have you with us as always.
Great to be here. I hope you had a good weekend. The sunshine was kind of a nice break.
It was a beautiful weekend. Thank you very much for asking. We're also joined by Dr. Audrey Haynes, professor of political science, at the University of Georgia and the founder and head of the Applied Politics Program at UGA. Audrey, I became a follower of your Applied Politics Program on Facebook, and I see you are routinely placing your students who go through the program in really terrific jobs in Washington and beyond.
Yes, we are. That is really the point of the program, is to give them access to people who can share their knowledge and experience with them in the classroom and beyond. And, you know, as they learn all of those great skills and how to build their relationship network, they apply it. And, you know, I get good news every day. And by the way, we just finished recruiting our sixth class for Applied Politics, so we'll be announcing the members of those shortly. But it's a great program, but we wouldn't be able to do it without so many of these great practitioners who work in D.C. and in the state and are willing to share all of their knowledge with students. There's a lot of paying it forward that goes on.
Well, congratulations for the success you're having. Julianne Thompson, longtime conservative activist in Georgia, Republican strategist, is back with us today. Julianne, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully, thank you, and I appreciate you having me. It's great to be here with everyone today.
Absolutely. Howard Franklin is one of the others that you're glad to be with, I know. Howard Franklin, a Democratic political consultant and also the managing partner at Ohio River South, Howard, do I dare say a lobbying and government relations firm?
Yes.
I know lobbying is not your favorite term, anybody's favorite term.
You know, we're doing our best to change how people feel about it, but this is a nice respite from the Capitol today. It is legislative day, five left, and after this, I'll be down there. So, yeah, I'll take it.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us, Howard. All right, let's get right to it. Jim Galloway, President Biden, Vice President Harris in town on Friday afternoon. as they made a visit to CDC to get a briefing on how things were going out there. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But later in the afternoon, they went over to Emory. They met with Asian American leaders in Georgia, some of them state representatives like Sam Park, who was on the show last week, B. Gwynn, who's been a frequent panelist on the show, and others. And Jim, let me play first what President Biden said when he made his remarks about the shootings at Emory University, and then we'll talk about it.
There are simply some core values and beliefs that should bring us together as Americans. One of them is standing together against hate, against racism, the ugly poison that has long haunted and plagued our nation. The Vice President and I, as I said, met with leaders from the Asian American community here in Georgia. We talked about Tuesday's mass shooting, about another example of public health crisis of gun violence in this country. 8 people killed, 7 women, 6 were of Asian descent. All fellow Americans, each one of them we mourn.
You know, Jim, one of the first things that struck me about his comments, no equivocating by President Biden. We've had this debate, or I don't know if debate, but certainly disagreement over whether this was a crime of hate against Asian Americans, whether it was misogyny, hatred of women in some way or another. But the president didn't go there. He just said this was a crime motivated by racism.
He's basically addressing the same line that Senator Raphael Warnock did yesterday on Meet the Press. Basically, you know, when asked if it was a hate crime, and he said, "We all know hate when we see it." One thing to note here is just under the auspices of this hate crimes bill that was passed only in last June, gender is included. Ethnicity does not have to be a determining factor. Gender can be as well.
Audrey, weigh in on this for us.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I've been reading some things about just general statistics from our Asian American communities. And, you know, there has been an uptick in violence. And one of the things that I learned was that generally, especially Asian women have been targets of criminal and non-criminal incidents involving sort of hate. And, you know, the two things may not be necessarily together all the time. They get a little complicated sometimes. But, you know, those numbers have been there for quite some time, but as the virus and some of the rhetoric that has emerged, those have increased as well. So you've seen the elderly, especially in high crime areas, Asian elderly, often the focus of criminal behavior, but then the racist attacks have increased as well over the last couple of years.
Julianne?
Yes, I agree with everything that's been said so far. And I think that we all need to be very, very alert as to the situations of bigotry that are affecting the Asian American community. I've heard from many friends about the hate that they encounter on a regular basis, especially that they have encountered as a result of a lot of people's racially motivated reactions to the pandemic, which has just been absolutely terrible, that that Asian Americans have been the victim of a lot of just terrible comments that have happened from officials as well as just regular citizens. And I know that there's been a lot of focus on this particular shooting incident at the massage parlors, and rightfully so. And I think as a result, it's important to not lose sight of the fact, you know, going back to what the professor said just a few minutes ago, and talking about criminal activity and Asian Americans that have been a target of a lot of criminal activity. I think it's important to remember that these types of businesses have been a bastion for sex trafficking that has particularly affected young Asian American or young Asian women and men. And we seriously also need to investigate how these dangers have affected that community and what we can do as a society to stop that.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'm glad that the president and the vice president spoke directly to this. I think we should also commend, I think, the Rainbow Coalition of leaders from both sides of the aisle who called the attack what we all plainly see it as, you know, racially motivated and deserving of the designation as a hate crime. Seeing Republican Chuck Abstraction and Democrat B. Wynn talk about this in the same breath gives me a little bit of hope that not everything has to be viewed through a partisan lens. So I thought it was good of us to come together. And, you know, I think it also marks the fact that Georgia is going to be the political center of the universe for, you know, a little while to come.
Yeah, Jim, Howard mentions Chuck Abstraction, the Republican, of course, from Gwinnett County, who was the principal sponsor of the hate crimes bill, which finally was passed last year after literally decades of efforts by some legislators to put a hate crimes law in place in Georgia. Ironically, it was usually fought because there were conservative legislators who did not want language that protected gays and lesbians. There wasn't as much, and some of it had to do with the fact that there were conservatives who said, "Oh, well, all crimes are basically hate crimes because they're violence against people of any kind is a hate crime." But the point is, for the most part, it was a prejudice about gays and lesbians that stopped it from passing in the past.
Right. And this is one thing that we need to keep in mind as we discuss this, is that this hate crimes bill in Georgia is very new. I don't believe that there have been any prosecutions under its auspices yet. The other thing to keep in mind is that that this was something when it was pushed through the legislature, this is something that law enforcement wanted. One of the big supporters of this was GBI, the former GBI director, Vernon. I'm blanking on his name here. Somebody help me out, please.
Vernon, we'll get to it.
It had plenty of law enforcement support. And so I don't think
Vernon Keenan, think, Jim. Vernon
thank
Keenan.
You very much. Vernon Keenan. Sorry, Vernon. What I'm getting at is that a little patience is necessary before we get the full kind of extent of the charges that are going to be placed against this young 21-year-old man.
All right. We're going to watch how this unfolds. I want to just mention one thing briefly, because Julianne makes the point about the fact that there are certainly, we are aware that there are some spas that are, in fact, dealing with dealing with sex workers. Perhaps sex trafficking has been involved in some of them. I'm going to be very careful on the show to talk about that at all, because we really don't know anything yet in detail, to the best of my knowledge, about these three particular spas. And we also want to honor the victims right now of these horrible shootings. So with your indulgence, all of you out there in the listening audience, I'm going to be very, very careful, although Julianne makes a good point, that the state for a long time has investigated, looked at some of the spas in Georgia to see whether, in fact, they are involved in prostitution, in sex trafficking, and that's something we want to keep an eye on. But for the time being, we're going to be kind of careful about that on Political Rewind, and I hope y'all understand that. Let's move on. Jim, you know, for the entire tenure of the virus when Donald Trump was president, the CDC was pushed to the side, was demonized by some in the Trump administration, certainly was overruled in many cases by administration folks who did not want to see the CDC issue independent reports of what was happening with the virus, tried to stop CDC from publishing guidelines that were done independently. And Jim, we all in this community, we all, our neighbors, some of our neighbors have worked at CDC forever. And during that period, Jim, we talked on this show any number of times about the fact that CDC people were being unfairly maligned, and all of that with President Biden's visit turned a corner this past Friday.
I've got a family member who works over at the CDC, and we were talking late Friday afternoon, right after Joe Biden made his appearance, and her reaction was almost just was one of bliss. Simply because, you know, she and her co-workers finally felt appreciated. If you'll recall, back in July, we had the Trump administration insert a loyalist there, and who was trying to rewrite some of the advice and findings that the CDC was handing out, and when he met resistance. He accused a cabal within the CDC of trying to usurp the Trump administration. So that was an extremely low point for what is pretty much everybody understands is the best pandemic oriented agency in the world.
Let's listen to just a little bit of what President Biden told CDC workers when he was visiting them on Friday afternoon.
But I came here to say thank you. Yeah. Because you're not only you're changing the psyche of the country, you're saving lives. You're saving lives. But you're changing the psyche of the country. And this is, as I said, I don't think we're being chauvinistic about our country, but this is, think about it. We're the only country in the world that has, every time we've gone into a crisis, have come out stronger immediately after the crisis than when we went in before the crisis.
Howard, as Jim points out, CDC workers, many of whom have been dedicated to that agency for many years, have waited a long time to hear a president of the United States thank them like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely well earned and overdue. And this president deserves credit for his administration springing into action and, you know, hitting that 100 million vaccinations goal weeks ahead of schedule. And I think just, you know, as he said, you know, very thoughtfully and very diplomatically, that the return to the upliftment of science is just an important part of what we're going to have to do in order to face down this pandemic. So we're all excited to see it, obviously even more so as Georgians in the home of the CDC.
Julianne, what is it, you know, President Trump did visit CDC early on in the pandemic, but even in that visit, the then president pretty much pushed CDC officials to the background so that he could command the attention of the media gathered there. Is this from a Republican point of view, is this a welcome change? Or do you think we give Biden too much credit in this moment for the way he is talking about the virus and the people who are fighting it?
Well, that's a very good question. I want to start out by saying I know that health workers in Georgia and the CDC are working really hard to get these doses administered, and we really need to thank them for their efforts to keep our community safe and healthy. As I mentioned to you before we actually started the show, my mother, who is over 75, and my brother, who's diabetic, have both been able to get their vaccines, and I feel very thankful for that, and they feel a lot safer, and I'm looking forward to the day that it opens up to where I can get it. All of that being said, I think it's to answer your question from a Republican perspective, I think it's important for those of us like myself who are not anti-vaccine and who have influence in Republican circles to be able to have our voices heard and work with health officials and the government where we can to alleviate a lot of the fear that I know that is being perpetrated in Republican circles where people have fear of these vaccines. Because, I mean, that fear for them is real, and it's very prevalent in Georgia. And I'm sure you've seen some of the television shows where they've interviewed Georgians about vaccines and talked about that fear. And I think that that, along with the fact that there seems to be a lot of fear among the African-American community as well as a result of a lot of the atrocities that have happened in the past. And I think that that is something that, that we are all cognizant of and should be very understanding of. And that being said, I think fear is another reason why I believe that we are slower to vaccinate en masse the way that that we are trying to do here in Georgia and around the country. And, you know, I'll do whatever I can to help with that. And I hope that other Republicans will as well.
And I'll follow up on that and say that in government generally, it's very important that some of the elements of our institutions remain non-political, particularly in the public health region. And this feels more like a transition back to the less political and politicization of public health issues. Biden has actually been very disciplined, I think, in terms of his messaging and also in terms of standing back and allowing some of those institutions to take a lead and work on the forefront of this issue. And for many professionals, you know, this is important, and it allows them to get the information out without the noise that comes from creating more of that political messaging rather than the public health messaging. So that's a positive. I mean, there's still elements of everything in politics that will stay political. But I think that in terms of the CDC and their mission, they feel that they now can carry it out with much less interference.
So we're going to get to our first break in the show in a moment, but we have talked on the show frequently about the rate of vaccination in Georgia and discussed the fact that for throughout the vaccination process across the country, Georgia has been last in the country in the number of shots in arms per 100,000. We had the governor's communications director, Cody Hall, on the show last week, who gave us a different interpretation of that, saying that Georgia's done a good job getting shots in the arms of the most vulnerable people, those 65 and older. I get that. But I do want to say, since we've been somewhat critical of the state, that they have now stepped up over the last few days. They had had a rate of vaccinations of about 78% of vaccine supply to shots in arms. They're now up to 86%. 3.2 million Georgians have now had a vaccine. 2+ million of them have had the first shot. Another 1,144,000 have had both shots. So the state is stepping up, and the state did just announce that, and the feds, because they're part of this, that Mercedes-Benz Stadium is going to be the site in the next couple weeks, where they're going to be putting 60, 70,000 shots into people's arms in the time ahead. So it may be a good sign, after all the criticism, that things are starting to pick up and more people are going to get vaccinated. Jim, before we go to break, you want to add to that?
Yeah, there's a really interesting AP report out this morning that says in Georgia and other states that opened the doors wide to a whole range of people to get the vaccine, they're actually having a slower rollout. And it's a very logistically oriented argument that because they had so many people eligible, the appointment systems, the internet, the technical systems could not handle the rush, and they crashed. So you have the states that have done a slower rollout have actually performed better in terms of shots into arms.
I'm glad you mentioned that. And the report indicates that South Carolina and Florida are the strongest examples of that, opening the door for so many people that the technology and the available vaccine and people to give the shots were not able to handle. I'm glad you brought that up. All right, let's do this. Let's get to our first break. A lot of election news in the legislature to talk about. We're going to do that in just a moment on Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Dr. Audrey Haynes, Julianne Thompson, Howard Franklin, Jim Galloway all join me for today's Political Rewind. Howard, the news out of the legislature in terms of these this rainstorm of election bills that have been introduced down there this session by Republicans is sort of a mixed bag today. And let's talk about what that means, Howard. Number one, some of the bills that Democrats were most concerned about, were really upset about, were automatic voter registration, an end to Sunday voting, and an end to no-excuse absentee balloting. And we've talked about all those pretty extensively on Political Rewind, but we do have to say that toward the end of last week, Republicans retreated on all three of those measures. Automatic voter registration will remain in place. Sunday voting will continue, and no-excuse absentee balloting will still be allowed. And in fact, after talking about reducing the number of early voting dates, it looks like the legislature is going to expand them. Those are victories for Democrats, yes, Howard?
Yeah, you could say that there were victories for Democrats. You could also look at this as a mixed bag. I know the Senate Bill 202 substitute that came out on Friday had some other, you know, very dangerous legislation or language included in it. It criminalized giving food or water to folks standing in long lines. actually made shorter the period that those drop boxes that we were able to use last year can be available. And also, I think it takes away the ability to solicit outside funds like grant dollars for elections offices. I mean, I've worked in government for a fair amount of time. I can't imagine outlawing the ability for local governments to be able to apply for and receive grant dollars to more effectively carry out their roles and responsibilities. So there's still some bad things in the Senate Bill 202, the sub. And of course, you know, we've got a bunch of different bills flying around. I think the expectation for the majority of the legislative session would be that the House would have a bill, the Senate would have a bill, and we'd have a conference committee to sort out what the details would be. So I don't think we're out of the woods on this or in a position to celebrate just yet.
Gee, Howard, I was trying to give you a chance to have a little something to take away positively. Yes, we are going to talk about the other elements of this bill that are still creating great controversy. So with that in mind, let me ask you about those few measures, first of all. Audrey Haynes, the question is, when they looked at no-excuse absentee balloting, and ending automatic voter registration, and especially eliminating Sunday voting, which would have been had such an impact on the souls to the polls votes in African American churches. Do you think Republicans realized that there was going to be too high a price to pay for taking those steps?
I certainly don't think they realized it initially, because look at the deluge of those pieces of legislation that were presented to the public. What they didn't realize, I think, is that there's no appetite. There's very limited appetite for most people who really think about these issues, including the businesses in the state. Moreover, we also have stronger leadership in terms of defending those rights than we've had previously in the state, and a great deal more transparency. It seems like it was such an obvious ploy. I mean, that was even people who don't think deeply about this. In listening to the deluge, I mean, you did have two groups, I mean, out there, and one group specifically was fed the lie that there was tremendous voter fraud when there actually wasn't. And you had a split within Democrats who were willing to tell that lie and those who were unwilling to tell that lie. So I think that most of the people in the public in the state of Georgia, I mean, you can't run away from the fact that it seems so obvious. And so with all of those factors coming in, I'm not surprised that they had to step back, especially when they were confronted with questions directed at, show us the fraud.
say there's a problem, show us where that problem is. And when you can't demonstrate in any sense where that problem is, you know, we're going to see some of this with probably legislation about, you know, defunding the police. Where is that actually happening? You know, is there a problem regarding that? So, yes, I think that the winners actually are not Democrats or Republicans. The winners are the people who want to vote in elections, and those include Republicans, Democrats, and independents.
Julianne?
Well, that's right. And I think that there's been a lot of data that's been coming in that show that Republicans use early and absentee voting, especially in 2020. I mean, there's been so much information that's come out that has shown that Republicans can no longer be classified as election day voters. More than half in the 2020 general election voted early or absentee. So I think that legislators know that overly restrictive measures on early voting are going to hurt their own electorate. I think that the real challenge for Republican lawmakers is to balance that knowledge with the very real issue that's on the mind of Republicans in 2020, and that is election reform and the fact that they're calling for election law changes. And they're going to have to focus on those changes in areas that actually enhance ballot security and bring confidence to voters, while at the same time measuring their own response by not cutting or restricting too much on the type of voting that their constituents use. It's a balancing act, and it's very, you know, it's very difficult, I'm sure, for Republican legislators right now, but it is the issue in the 2020 legislative session for Republicans, not just in Georgia, but around the country.
Bill, one of the things we haven't talked about yet is the runoff issue, and that's where I think that's if you're looking at a place where Republicans are putting a thumb on the scale, that's where it is. The January 5th victories of John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock in the two Senate runoffs were just a watershed moment, because Democrats had been skunked essentially in all those previous runoffs to dating back to 1992, and in part it's because the Georgia state law required the runoff within 4 weeks of the original election date. You know, if you have a general election first Tuesday in November, well, that first Tuesday in December is coming right after Thanksgiving, and it's very, very hard because Republican voters were older voters. They were the ones more likely to turn out and save the Republican candidate here. In 2013, there was a federal lawsuit that noted that expatriate Georgians and Georgians in the military serving overseas couldn't participate in runoffs because of the absentee ballot issue. It just took too long. So in 2013, there was a federal judge who ordered that runoffs, for federal runoffs only, not state runoffs, federal runoffs would be shifted to 9 weeks after the voting date, i.e. the first Tuesday in January. That gave Democrats two crucial elements. One was time, and the other one was money, because they had essentially 2 months to organize both. This sends it back to the original 4 weeks.
Okay, so Howard, I want to get you in here, but let me make a point about what Jim just said, because this is the other side of what's happening down there. Yes, you were right, Howard, reducing the number of drop boxes and insisting that they put inside early voting locations is one of the measures that you mentioned a few minutes ago. Republicans are still pushing. But what Jim just talked about are two interesting proposals that emerged from this 93-94 page massive bill, which came out of this. It's the House version of what the Senate sent them. And here's the two things it did. Number one, as Jim points out, it reduces again to 4 weeks the time period between a general election and a runoff election. It also has an interesting twist on military and overseas balloting. It says there will be instant runoffs in those cases. In other words, if I'm an overseas voter, I will say, this is the candidate I want to elect in the general election. Oh, if there's a runoff, this is the candidate I want to win that race. So that's one thing. The other thing that they've added is that there should be primaries in special election campaigns. So let me take it one step further and turn it over to you. Sorry, I'm talking so much. What this means is, certainly in the Raphael Warnock-Kelly Loeffler race, had there been a Republican primary and Doug Collins and Kelly Loeffler had duked it out there and we'd had one person emerge to challenge Warnock, Republicans think they could have won that race. On the other side of that, David Perdue came within a hair's breadth of winning against John Ossoff in the general election. But because of the 9-week voting period for the runoff, Democrats, as you know, Howard, were able to build up a big money lead, as Jim pointed out. They were able to push forward on getting Warnock elected. I mean, on Ossoff elected. So both of those measures tend right now to favor Republicans. Now it's your turn.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that this is, I think what Julianne mentioned earlier, you know, the elections reform has been the legislative soup du jour during the General Assembly. I doubt very seriously that it is what rank and file Republican voters are concerned about or rank among their top issues once we get outside the session when we're talking about kitchen table issues. These are issues that Democrats are going to have to figure out how to contend with. But, you know, keep in mind, we're a resilient party. We figured it out before. I think even in your example, I don't believe that the, for instance, in the Senator in the Senator Perdue race, this wouldn't have prevented Perdue from going to a runoff. It just would have given him a few thousand or several thousand additional votes from overseas military folks who had voted in the general and then began him with a little bit of a head start potentially in the runoff, as I understand it. So I think you just got to be careful what you wish for. I think the Republicans have had control of the, you know, the elections machinery for the better part of the last two decades. And it hasn't, and it did not stop this watershed election in November and in January. I just think you got to be really careful what you work for. And I think that, you know, the folks with Stacey Abrams and Fair Fight and across the country have figured out and shown the ability to be resilient no matter how the rules get changed or how the goalposts happen to move.
Yes, Howard is absolutely right. I would also note that, you know, instances like these, especially with the special elections and runoffs, are somewhat rare, right? Especially that special election that was generated with that huge jungle primary that we had. So parties always innovate, and whatever challenges you put forward, they will find a way to drum up votes. And even if they are creating what seems like an advantage at this point, you know, will it be an advantage in 20 years from now or 10 years from now? Because things are changing. In fact, if you look at all the growth that's happening and, you know, when we have new redistricting at the state level, I expect that Democrats are going to win more seats in the Georgia General Assembly. And you know, some of these things that are being done now are likely going to benefit them in the future. So you always have to be careful when you're making changes to election systems, and the best way to do it is to think long and hard about what you're doing, because there are always unintended consequences.
Yeah, Bill, what's interesting here is, and just to build on what Audrey was saying, listeners out there might think that this is Republicans have taken a very, very complicated route to get what they want, and they have because there was a far more simpler solution to all of this, and that is don't mandate a 50% plus one result. We could have gone back in mid 1990s. We had a system whereby if you finished the finisher with the most votes over 45% was automatically the winner. They could have gone back to that system, eliminated all the runoffs. They chose not to.
Yeah, that's a great, great point, Jim. Why haven't they looked at eliminating the 50% plus one mandate to win an election? Julianne, I want to give you a chance to weigh in, excuse me, before we take a break here. It does seem like Republicans are going about this in a very complicated way. Look at how long it took me to explain what these two measures they've now brought forth are going to mean.
Well, yes, it's being done very surgically and very precise, which it has to be. I mean, we're talking about a fundamental right of our citizens to vote. I think when I talk to people, the instant runoffs with the Uecava ballots are just kind of a no-brainer among most of the people that I talk to. It makes a lot of sense, and I agree with that. Primaries and special elections, I would be interested, although I have not read this section in detail about the primaries and special elections, but I would be interested to know if there are any funding increases that come with that sort of a mandate, because, I mean, that adds a great deal of expense to the election process. So I would be interested in knowing that, because being fiscally responsible is very important to me as well.
Julianne, as somebody who's had a real leadership role in many conservative issues over the years, what do you think when you hear Jim Galloway say that perhaps it's time to eliminate 50% plus one victories?
I agree with him 100%. I absolutely agree with that. Absolutely.
Okay. That's interesting news. Thank you for saying that. Let's get to our final break of the show. We'll be right back with more on Political Rewind. Julianne Thompson, Howard Franklin, Jim Galloway, Professor Audrey Haynes join us today. So every morning at about 5:15, 5:30, I write what in NPR language we call a billboard. It's what you hear. If you listen to us on the radio rather than on podcast, you hear it before NPR News. I give a rundown of what we're going to talk about. So this morning, I wrote that, and one of the things I said was, it looks like Brad Raffensperger may get a challenger pretty soon in the reelection campaign for Secretary of State. I was careful to couch it in language that didn't make assumptions. I said, maybe Jody Heiss, the congressman's going to run. Well, Galloway, while we're on the air, we get news. Jody Heiss has now announced that he is going to go after Brad Raffensperger's Secretary of State job.
Yeah, it says a couple of things. Number one, it says that being the minority in the U.S. House is no fun, no matter how many bombs you throw, but it also puts front and center in the 2022 primary the issue of Donald Trump, the outcome of the 2020 election, and everyone's reaction to it. Jody Heiss was one of those people who was in favor of dumping 5 million Georgia votes into the Chattahoochee River when it came to the presidential contest. He was also, if you'll recall, he put up a post on social media on January 6th during the Capitol riot, saying this is our 1776 moment. Which he is going to have to explain. He put that up before the violence started. There's going to be some history that has to be exhumed.
Julianne, Heiss was a little bit careful in the way, we'll hear how he talks about this going forward, but two things about it. Number one, here's what he said about Raffensperger. He said, quote, "Free and fair elections are the foundation of our country. What Brad Raffensperger did was create cracks in the integrity of our elections, which I wholeheartedly believe individuals took advantage of in 2020. It'll be interesting to hear how he explains just what he meant by that. I was interested in the fact, though, that what he did not say was Brad Raffensperger refused to acknowledge that Georgia's election of Joe Biden was done through fraud and deceit. I thought that was interesting because certainly he's essentially endorsed that position in the past.
He has, and most certainly the primary for SOS is, and the Republican primary is going to be a referendum one way or another on the performance of the office. That being said, Jody Heiss is not the only Republican that has announced that he's running. Former mayor of Alpharetta, David Belisle, has also announced that he is seeking that position as well, and he has already started running. So it's quickly becoming a crowded primary, and it'll be interesting to watch. And as well, earlier in the week, we heard that the president is going to be making an announcement here in Georgia today. So it'll be interesting to see, is that going to be in the Secretary of State's race? Will that have to do with the United States Senate? There's a lot of talk about Herschel Walker where that's concerned. So what is the president actually coming to Georgia or announcing about Georgia with regard to his endorsement for 2022?
Bill, I just think this keeps Georgia, you know, squarely at the center of the political universe for at least another election cycle, probably for a bit longer. You know, and I think the difficulty here for Republicans who are trying to turn the page in the Trump presidency, who are, you know, hoping to make some changes to the state's election system and then to put behind them these unfounded claims and accusations about voter fraud, they're going to have a completely different reckoning, especially when you put the chief elections officer, you know, on trial, or as you guys mentioned, a referendum on his service. I honestly don't believe, you know, I appreciate what you said, Bill, about Congressman Heiss being careful with his word choice at the outset of this announcement. But I guarantee you, we all have watched Republican primaries. They only go in one direction. They're not going to get more civil. They're not going to, you know, tack more toward the truth. They're gonna go in a direction that's going to be difficult for middle-of-the-road independents and conservatives to really see themselves in any of the rhetoric that's coming out of them. So I think this is just difficult for all the constitutional officers who are on the ballot in 2022 to have this conversation while they're also trying to, you know, fight for re-election.
I think that's a really good point, and I want to pick up on it with you, if I may, Audrey. Although first, let me say, Vernon Jones, we're told, is also thinking about being a Republican candidate for Secretary of State, and he certainly won the favor of Donald Trump in aligning with him as a former Democrat. And an African American on calling the election in Georgia fraud. But Audrey, Bea Gwin is being considered a possible candidate for that Secretary of State's job. And here's the larger question, and Howard raised it. Our constitutional offices have been held by Republicans, all Republicans, for almost two decades. Is 2022 the year, given the purpling of Georgia, when we might see genuinely competitive races that Democrats could win in some of these constitutional races?
Well, you know what? I think that most of us who study politics hope that is the case, because one of the things that we know is that when these elections become more competitive, it's more likely we're going to see some good ideas, better ideas, and more competition of ideas. And hopefully that will benefit the state of Georgia. I would say that especially the Secretary of State's office should be held by someone who takes their job seriously, takes their oath to the state and its public seriously, because the last thing you really want to see injected into the Secretary of State's office is higher, greater politicization. I think that in terms of this race, it's going to be competitive, but I think Raffensperger is going to benefit from, in the primary, votes from independents, moderate Democrats who thought that he handled the question of, you know, fake fraud much better than expected. And I can't see someone like Jody Heiss, who has been so strongly associated with Trump and Stop the Steal and the insurrection, you know, winning a statewide election. I think that's going to be a really hard carry for him at this point.
So, Julianne, let me ask you another hard question. Is Brad Raffensperger almost guaranteed to lose the Republican base in a primary runoff after the way he refused to accede to the former president's insistence that he call the Georgia presidential race a fraud?
Well, I think it depends on what you consider to be the Republican base. If you are talking about Republican Party activists, most definitely so. If you are talking about rank and file Republicans, like a lot of the people that live in my neighborhood that are really not into a lot of these particular issues when it comes to arguing amongst ourselves, I don't know. It remains to be seen. I'm not going to try to predict that particular race, but it is definitely going to be a heated one. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And I think when it comes to 2022, all of the constitutional officers that are up for reelection are in for some heated primaries. And, you know, Georgians have a history, especially Georgia Republicans have a history of being independent-minded. So I think if you look at the fact that, you know, things that have happened in the past with regard to elections, we're more independent-minded. So I don't know that outside interference is going to make a big difference.
Julianne Thompson gets the last word on today's show. Thank you for being with us, Howard Franklin, Professor Audrey Haynes, Jim Galloway. A pleasure to have all of you here for the conversation today. We're going to be back with another edition of Political Rewind, of course, tomorrow. I hope you'll all join us then. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nygut. Take care. Stay healthy. Wear a mask. And if you haven't gotten a vaccine so far, this is a great time to start planning how you're going to do it. See y'all tomorrow.